This photograph appeared on the cover of the New York Times Magazine section a couple years ago, and if physicists know anything about Freeman Dyson, it's that he is one of the founders of quantum electrodynamics. If the general public knows anything about him, it's probably that he has something weird to do with climate, and indeed, he's probably the most eminent scientist who goes to a lot of trouble to question climate science and the principal findings of climate scientists who publish in places like Nature, and I'm going to talk about that a little later. And one of the things that gets him in trouble is saying things like that. I'm happy every time the Chinese and Indians make a strong statement about going ahead with burning coal. We're not supposed to think that way, are we? Much less a guy who votes for Obama and is a friend of Rush Holt, former Congressman Rush Holt. He looks like a war criminal there, doesn't he? But I'm going to talk about his career and try and persuade you that he's not a war criminal. He's not a monster. He's a very reasonable guy, very accomplished. And this is an outline of my talk, the things I'm going to say. And the thesis of my talk is that he is the Ralph Waldo Emerson for our time. Who the heck is Ralph Waldo Emerson? He's probably the leading 19th century American intellectual. He lectured and then compiled his lectures into books. He talked about religion. He talked about slavery. He lived in the mid-third of, he was active in the mid-third of the 19th century. Literature, science, he knew a lot about science. He wrote poetry. He influenced several literary movements. And not all of those things are the same thing as what Dyson has come to do, but I have a feeling that if Emerson were alive now, maybe he would be a physicist who operated in the mode that Dyson did. This is young Freeman Dyson. He grew up in Winchester, England, and Winchester has a very good public school, which is to say private school. And they considered themselves to be the best school in Britain. And Freeman Dyson's father was the head of music department there, and he took the test along with everyone else, and that year he got the top score on all the categories. So I call him the best schoolboy in Britain. And if you go there, it looks a lot like the Hogwarts school in the Harry Potter movies. The students eat off of trestle tables from the 1600s. And that's what Dyson looked like at that time in the 30s. He looks a little bit, very serious look on his face. He looked a little bit like Harry Potter, and the other students sort of treated him like Harry Potter. They deferred to him. He won all the math prizes. If you were the second best student in the school in math, you didn't like Freeman Dyson. He didn't bother taking science classes. They taught very few. The one science class he took was a chemistry class, and what did they discuss there? Not chemistry. They read poems every single time. That's where Dyson said that he got his love of poetry. He was a great fan of science fiction, H.G. Wells, Jules Verne. You didn't need science classes because you studied that stuff on your own, or you conferred with two or three of your pals. Now, a lot of graduate students do that already, but he was in the seventh, eighth, ninth grade when he was doing it. He went off to Cambridge University, and as a freshman, he was essentially a PhD student. He was working, operating at that level, publishing papers long before he got to grad school. Every day he came to Winchester School, he had to pass through this war memorial dedicated to the boys of Winchester School who had lost their lives in the First World War. Class of 1912, wiped out entirely. Class of 1913, wiped out entirely. Class of 1914, 90%. And World War II was looming. Dyson felt that he wasn't going to make it either. But he did. C.P. Snow, the guy who wrote the famous essay about the two cultures in the 1950s, he was in charge of getting bright lads like Dyson and grabbing them and putting them in places where they could do some good. So at the age of 19, Dyson was working for Bomber Command, and he, I won't say he initiated operations research, but he was one of the first. So here he's 19, and he tells the RAF, your bombers are too far apart. Bring them closer together. I said, what? Are we going to have a lot of wingtip collisions? Yes, the wingtip collisions go up. But when you mass the bombers, you have a better defense against the German fighters. And so the survival rate actually went up for a while. So Dyson looked like a genius. The aim was to kill as many Germans and to save as many Brits as you could, the pilots. I think the RAF, these sorts of fighting was among the highest casualty rates in the war, the bomber pilots who flew these missions. They killed 400,000 Germans, and this bothered Dyson then, and it bothered him for the rest of his life. He said that if the Germans had won the war, he, Dyson, and a lot of other people like him would have been put on trial at a Nuremberg-style rally, and he never could shake off that feeling. Now you say, you know, this was World War, this was total war. We had to do this. We had to bomb the German city. He said, if you'd siphon off half of those bombers and put them more out over the North Atlantic to try and kill German submarines, you would have done a better job and ended the war sooner. The Allies prevailed, and Dyson had to spend one more year in military service, and he got very cushy duty at Imperial College. He could do anything he wanted. He sat at a desk and read quantum mechanics textbooks all day. Until then, he was a very good mathematician, and he was looking forward to being a mathematician, but he got the physics bug. Maybe many of you in this audience got that bug at some point. For me, it was senior year in high school. Something catches fire in your head, and he had to do physics. But he was reading other things as well, and I'm going to circle back to this later in the talk. William James, the American philosopher and psychologist, the brother of novelist Henry James, was a big influence on Dyson. Dyson's favorite poet was William Blake, the visionary poet. I'll come back to him also. Olaf Stapledon is a writer of science fiction from the 1930s. Not many people know about, even people who read science fiction don't know about Stapledon, but he was very popular in the 30s. I tried reading him, I find him unreadable because there are no characters. It's just things happen in universe after universe, and the universe branches. It's sort of an early version of the many worlds theory. So Dyson knew he had to go into physics, and there weren't enough interesting people in Britain for him to talk about, even though people like Dirac was still alive. And his first choice was to go to Moscow and study with Kapitsa or Lev Landau, but it was impossible to get a visa. Nobody came into the Soviet Union in those years. And he spoke to a few people who told him, the place to go if you want action is America, and how about going to Cornell with Hans Bethe? And that's what Dyson did. Let me just spend a moment to talk about what was happening in physics then. The biggest pre-World War II physics meeting was the 1927 Solvay conference, where the big issue was quantum weirdness, Niels Bohr versus Albert Einstein. Then in the 30s, quantum mechanics was still quite useful, was evolving, but some cracks started to show in the theory. Had to do with the way the electron interacts with the electromagnetic field. And so a meeting was convened way out on the end of Long Island in 1947. Some of the top people in the world who weren't trapped in Europe or Japan at the time were there, a who's who of scientists. There's Oppenheimer, there's Feynman with the socks. All these heavyweight theorists, the most important man at this meeting was that guy, an experimentalist, Willis Lamb. He had spent the war years shooting radar waves at German fighters, and now what he was doing was shooting microwaves into hydrogen atoms, and he measured a slight shift, or he measured this shift to high accuracy. It's a shift because of the weird stuff that's happening in vacuum. It's a shift we now call the Lamb shift, of course. And everybody knew that we had to renormalize this interaction, the electromagnetic interaction, electrons and the electromagnetic field, and the struggle was on to find the right theory. Here's a follow-up to the Shelter Island meeting a year later in Pennsylvania. It was basically a heavyweight bout, a boxing match between these two men. Richard Feynman, everybody knows Richard Feynman. He came with his unique brand of quantum reality. This is Julian Schwinger, graduated something like 80 physics PhDs at Harvard. The who's who of quantum mechanics in the 50s, 60s, 70s, Glashow, Roy Glauber, and many more. Your roommate, isn't Mr. Sawyer a graduate of, didn't he get his PhD under Schwerin? Walter Cohn is another. I was just looking at the list of Schwinger PhDs. Schwinger thought he had the solution, and he did. And he described this renormalization in somewhat conventional field theory. And he spoke for about 5 hours uninterrupted. You're only going to have to listen to me for 55 or 60 minutes. But they sat through this, and they were just stunned. Then they had lunch, and then poor Feynman stuff. You don't usually have to say poor Feynman, because he usually wins all his arguments, and he's such a charming fellow. But on that day, he lost. He was the loser of this big battle. It looked as if Schwinger had won the day. And there are two other photographs there. They were people who weren't at the meeting, but should have been. Tomonaga was doing what Schwinger was doing, only he was doing it in Tokyo while bombs were falling on him. And you know how he found out about the lamb shift? He read about it in Newsweek magazine in the U.S. Army Library in Tokyo. So he rushed off a paper to Oppie, who did the honorable thing and saw it through to publication. The other guy who should have been there but wasn't was this 25-year-old grad student. Dyson was a first-year physics grad student, and Beta, after that Shelter Island meeting, had tried to quickly calculate what the lamb shift should be, and he came pretty close, but it was still a ragged theory, and he said to Dyson, here, why don't you make it relativistic? Why don't you clean it up? And in about 1 month, this first-year grad student did that. So Beta thought that this youngster should be at the meeting, and Oppenheimer, who was in charge of the meeting, said, no, we have to keep it high level, so Dyson wasn't there. Instead, he got something just as good as being at that meeting. The spring of 1948, he had essentially Richard Feynman to himself all the time, all day, every day, for a whole semester. Beta was his nominal thesis advisor at Cornell, but Dyson spent every day, just as you do, you know, in twos and threes in your offices. That was Dyson and Feynman arguing about quantum electrodynamics. In June of that year, let me back up, saying in 1948 was a wonderful year. The novelist Jack Kerouac wrote the book On the Road. He traveled all over America, and that's a book that many high school seniors are forced to read. I didn't particularly like it. So Dyson and Feynman took a famous car ride. It's described in an article in Physics Today. Feynman wrote about it. Dyson wrote about it. Down to New Mexico. And so the two of them were talking about QED the whole way. Dyson then he loves riding Greyhound buses. I grew up in Chicago. They're big parts of the country. I'd never seen. Then you get way out here. It's a revelation to see the whole rest of the United States. He took a Greyhound bus up to Ann Arbor, where Schwinger was teaching a course in QED. And so Dyson studied at the feet of Schwinger for like 6 weeks. So now he had the Feynman side and the Schwinger side. Dyson's head was just exploding. He escaped by another Greyhound bus to Berkeley, and he enjoyed it a lot. Who doesn't like Berkeley? But he could not relax. He could not relax. So he got back on another Greyhound bus, and here's where, I think it's Nebraska, where a lightning bolt occurred in his head. He knew how to bring the two theories together. He was so excited, he got off the bus in Chicago and spent 3 days writing up all his ideas. He got back on the bus, and he came not to Ithaca. Already he was two semesters at Cornell, he was already done there. Beta said, you're too much for me, go down and spend the year with Oppenheimer. And Oppenheimer said, sure, bring him to, and there was Dyson and a dozen other postdocs, physics postdocs, all crammed into a single room. Many of you have to share your office with one or two. Imagine sharing it with 11 or 12, all in one room. And Dyson had to keep all this QED stuff. Now, he had the total solution, the total synthesis in his head, but he saved it for the day when he would give a talk. And Oppenheimer was there. And Oppenheimer, we think of as this giant figure, and a peacekeeper and a diplomat, but at least for Dyson, he He was very sarcastic. He hated Dyson's ideas. He interrupted Dyson every 14 seconds, like Wolfgang Pauli. And this went on for a couple of seminars. And Dyson appealed to his mentor, Hans Bethe, and Bethe said to Oppie, "We shut up and just let the man talk." So they scheduled a full slate of five or six talks, November, December, 48. And after the final one, Dyson got a two-word note from Oppie that said in Latin, "Nolo contendere." I'm not arguing anymore. In other words, I give up, you win. And Dyson was now not the most famous physicist in the world, but he's the one you had to hear about. There's his paper that he wrote. Note the title. He's not claiming QED for himself. Tominaga, Schwinger, Feynman. He asked Feynman, and I should point out, and this is an important thing, at this point, at this moment, Schwinger and Feynman had not published their own results. Indeed, for the first couple of years, they were known as Feynman-Dyson graphs. We call them Feynman diagrams now, but that's what they were called for a couple of years. He gave dozens of talks. He was the one, he went back to Pyrrhals, he taught Pyrrhals the new QED stuff. All of his mentors, he had to teach them now. He was in the driver's seat. Job offers came all over the place. See, that's a frustrated bunch of physicists there trying to hear him. They can't get in. Well, let's stop and just quickly summarize what has happened to Mr. Dyson so far. He spent 2 years at Cambridge, undergraduate, 2 years doing war duty. He spent a kind of a nothing year in London, but at least he made up his mind to do physics rather than math. Spent 1 year getting a master's degree at Cambridge, 1 year at Cornell, 1 year at Institute for Advanced Study. Because he could have stayed in America, but he said he had promised the underwriter of his American studies that he would come back to Britain for at least 2 years, and he did that. He studied for Rudolf Pyrrhals at Birmingham, where Jim Langer got his degree. We were just talking about that. And one little factoid, Dyson and many of his students lived with, many of Pyrrhals' students lived with him. And the previous occupier of the room that Dyson was staying in, who'd been there just a year or two before, was this young German scientist who turned out to be the most famous spy in history, Klaus Fuchs, who gave all the atomic secrets from Los Alamos to the Soviets. Dyson was always very savvy in having interesting summers. He spent the summer of 51 with Wolfgang Pauli. Dyson was just then, one thing that Dyson did that Schwinger and Feynman had not done is to show that every term of the perturbation series expansion for QED is finite. And he wanted to show, though, as a good mathematician, that the whole series converged. And Pauli said, "You're not going to do it." And indeed, Dyson did not do it. He went to Cornell and took over the quantum franchise there. Bethe had always taught this quantum course. Then when young Richard Feynman came along as an assistant professor, he inherited the class. And then when Feynman left to go to Caltech in 51, Dyson got it. So he's got no degree. He's a one-year graduate student, but he's the new professor of physics at Cornell teaching this class. The very young Shelley Glashow and Steve Weinberg, they were Cornell undergraduates. They tried to take the class but couldn't keep up and had to drop out. He tried to extend this QED method to the strong interactions, and David Gross there knows why. It could explain why that's not going to work. The strong force is too strong. So Dyson at this point felt kind of a hangdog feeling. He had led several graduate students over this cliff that went nowhere, and he didn't like the idea of spending so many years, so much time on a single topic. So he vowed he would never do that again. He asked Oppenheimer for a permanent job at the Institute for Advanced Studies, and Oppenheimer was glad to give it to him. So from 1953 until now, he is still, he's retired, but he's an emeritus professor there. That's the Institute for Advanced Study there. Dyson started writing articles for the popular media. He wrote for Scientific American, Physics Today, a few other magazines. Again, a brilliant choice for summer activity. Particle physics wasn't enough, so he went out to Berkeley, and with Charles Cattell, he started studying condensed matter physics. Here's the start of a really fun little venture. He's this theoretical mathematical physicist, but he's going to do engineering. This is General Dynamics, one of the largest defense contractors in the world. They now had a nuclear arm called General Atomic, a man there named Freddy de Hoffman, who had been instrumental in negotiating with the Soviets about treaties, invited Dyson and Teller to come and design an intrinsically safe, what they called a safe reactor. And so they spent the summer in designing this thing called TRIGA, test reactor, and I forget what IGA stands for. Intrinsically safe because the fuel rods have some temperature dependent components to them. So if the reactor gets too hot, these heat dependent materials shut off the nuclear reaction. So you don't even need fuel rods. It's intrinsically safe. One of the greatest best-selling reactor designs in history. There's something like 70 of them that were made. This prototype was the first nuclear reactor operating in Africa. And about 100 meters from my office at the University of Maryland is one of these TRIGA reactors. It's usually just used for training students. So this is, and Dyson loved working with Teller. Teller at this point in the mid-60s was still persona non grata for what was perceived as his great betrayal of Oppenheimer. Nuclear-powered rocket ship. So de Hoffman had this even weirder idea. Let me back up. 1957 was Sputnik. 1958, the great civilian rocket department of the United States government was just then coming into business. And we take NASA for granted. But for about 1 year, the people at General Dynamics, including Teller, Dyson, this bomb engineer named Ted Taylor, figured that they could beat NASA. They could defeat chemical-powered rockets using nuclear-powered rocket ships. And it would make a great movie this year, 58 and 59. So here's how it works. This is the rocket ship. It's fully standing up. It's about the size of an Apollo rig, you know, on the Saturn V rocket. Look at that, livestock. You squirt an atomic bomb out the back. It explodes. It's a couple hundred meters there. If you have a carefully coated sacrificial layer of stuff, I don't know what it was, but the blast slams into the back of the rocket, vaporizes this layer, gives a big plasma oomph. And is there a big acceleration here? Yes, you bet. So like a fourth of the third of the craft is shock absorber. So the craft is moving forward, but all of this is crew and storage for stuff, and then the crew sits up here. And here is Dyson, is, you'll see as the talk goes along, he is always high-minded, and here is a manifesto. Nothing less than a manifesto. That's what he calls it. Our purpose and our belief is that the bombs which killed and maimed at Hiroshima and Nagasaki shall one day open the skies to men. Dyson was too young to have been at the Manhattan Project, but he sort of envied all those people that had. And he felt, and many of the people on this project felt, that this could be as big a project as Manhattan if they could just get it off the ground. Never worked that way. It's just, can you imagine trying to blast off a rocket? You'd have to put it on the top of this tower and have it launch from there. It didn't work. It didn't work. Dyson went on talking about it for years. One man who was impressed was Stanley Kubrick, who just a couple of years later was going to use the Orion-style acceleration system. That was the motto of Orion Project, by the way, Saturn by 1970. Mind-boggling, is it? That they thought that, and yes, you could achieve accelerations that high to get to Saturn in 1970. But there's this little matter of blowing off atomic bombs, you know, at Earth level, and then blasting out of the atmosphere. Kubrick eventually abandoned the idea of the Orion principle, but one thing he did do was to interview Dyson and four or five other notable scientists like Margaret Mead, Isaac Asimov, about what they think space travel should be or could be, and these interviews were going to be part of the movie. So Dyson was nearly an actor in the movie Space Odyssey, 2001, and Kubrick sensibly chopped all those bits out. So the movie's just the movie. Let me just spend 30 seconds talking about Dyson, the family man. He married Verena Huber, a brilliant mathematician. He met her at the Institute for Advanced Study. Very, very, very troubled marriage. Read my book. I give it two chapters. These are their two children. George Dyson is now a science historian and probably the world's expert builder of ocean-going kayaks. Long story behind that. And this is Esther Dyson, who in the 1990s made a lot of money selling, promoting companies in Eastern Europe. She had a New York Times column. She was one of the first great promoter of the early internet, and she became a later philanthropist and eventually a cosmonaut. She spent several million dollars of her own money to be a cosmonaut. That's the second Mrs. Dyson, Emma Jung, who was an au pair in the Dyson household. And that's the home that they have lived in for 60 years in Princeton. And here is Emma with her four daughters, a nurse, a veterinarian, and two MDs. And Emma herself, one of the daughters gave her running shoes on her 50th birthday. She took up long distance running. And for her age group, she has won the Boston Marathon, the San Francisco Marathon. So she's a very interesting person herself. All right, let's get back to Dyson's career. In 1958, Philip Morrison, who was then at Cornell still, before he went to MIT, published a paper talking about how we could look for faraway alien civilizations by monitoring their radio signals. You know, we here on Earth, we send out I Love Lucy, right? Those are traveling out for years and years into, for decades now, into the galaxy. And Dyson said, well, you know, these alien civilizations, maybe they don't want us to know that they're broadcasting their own version of I Love Lucy, and they would disguise their cultural attributes. But one thing these cultures couldn't do would be to disguise their heat emissions. You can't hide the heat. The heat's going to get out somewhere. So a better thing to do would be to look in the infrared. And we have looked in these. So the Dyson paper and the Morrison paper are, I would argue, two of the foundation arguments in the serious scientific effort to search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And as part of that paper, he said, well, what would this heat look like? And he imagined that a really advanced civilization could take Jupiter and take it apart and reassemble those parts in bands, maybe at the radius of the Earth's orbit around the sun, and that would act as a platform where people could live and where you could soak up more and more of the solar radiation, an idea that spawned dozens of novels and short stories. 1962, this is the time of one of the most dangerous moments in world history, the Cuban Missile Crisis, October of 1992, a standoff in Cuba, which was disaster was averted, but it hastened the Americans and the Soviets and the Brits to find some way of controlling, limiting nuclear testing. The testing itself was nasty. In 1963, something like they estimate 1,000 people per year were dying from the residual radiation that came down. Dyson himself was against the test ban treaty at first because his buddy Edward Teller and he liked promulgating the use of nuclear bombs for peaceful testing. They're drilling a harbor there the easy way by blowing up Santa Barbara, the Goleta Beach there to make a harbor. But Dyson graphed strontium here. This is in various milk sheds, as they're called, milk areas of California. Here's the strontium. You can see how in 63 it was reaching a climax. And the Soviets didn't want on-site inspections. The Americans didn't want to give up this peaceful use. And Dyson helped to maneuver the negotiators into coming to the final wording, and a treaty was struck, which is held to this day. No open air testing since. I'm going to talk about Jason's just for a moment. Jason is a private collection of scientists, self-appointed scientists. New Jasons are appointed by current members of Jason. In the 1960s, when it began, it was maybe 30 or 40. They were all men. They were all physicists, some of them very prestigious. And the way things worked in the spring, the government would meet with the Jasons and say, we want you to study submarine noise. They would give them an assignment, go out and come back. They would go to La Jolla or something like that for 6 weeks, study the matter, write a report, and hand it over to the Pentagon. The Pentagon said, thank you. They never said whether they used the report or not, but that's the way Jason operated. And Dyson was a member since the early 1960s. I'm going to talk about just two things that he said was maybe his best contribution to Jason, the study, the founding of what later was called adaptive optics. You look up at the sky at a twinkling star, and atmospheric turbulence messes up your view of that galaxy or that distant object. If we could somehow flex the mirror on a basis, and I forget how often nowadays the flexing occurs, several times a second, few hundred times a second. This was about 1972. Weinberg, Dyson, Richard Muller at Berkeley, and it was classified, the idea was classified. Even more classified was the way a thing called laser guide star, Will Happer at Princeton, I think, had the idea. You shine a laser up and you tickle the sodium layer that's, 200 miles up, and it shines back down. And from that, you can determine what's happening to the thermal cells in the atmosphere overhead. And you use, that's what you feed into your computer to actuate the mirrors, and you get a much better, a much clearer view. Just as the commercial power industry, nuclear power industry, was spawned by the need, the Navy wanted reactors to stick at the back end of their submarines, the Air Force drove the development of adaptive optics. The Air Force wanted to shoot down upcoming missiles from the Soviet Union, and they wanted a really clear way of getting at them. The other topic, Vietnam, very painful subject. Nowadays, you know, you open your daily paper and the map you see is of Syria or Afghanistan. In the 1960s and early 70s, this was the place that caused the most pain, Vietnam. America had 500,000 soldiers over there. That springtime meeting where the Pentagon meets with the Jason members to tell them what they would like, they were at this meeting and a United States general standing, and maybe he had a drink in his hand, but apropos of what to do with the communist soldiers infiltrating down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, he said, why don't we throw in some nukes? Sounds casual, and Dyson was standing there, Steven Weinberg was standing there. They conferred, and they said, was he serious? And they concluded he was, and that they better write a report. So the government had not asked for a Jason report about tactical nuclear weapons in Vietnam, but they wrote one anyway. For decades, they didn't know who this general was, but we now know that it was Maxwell Taylor, who had been the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the mid-60s, up until 65, 66. They decided, writing this report, to say nothing about the morality of dropping tactical nuclear weapons in these hamlets and burning down hillsides and mountain passes. In the end, what they think was the most important suggestion was that it's hard to spot these Viet Cong infiltrators, but American soldiers, they were really easy to spot in Vietnam. They would sit 30 or 40,000 times at a fortified place in the jungle, and either tunneling or we were all too comfortable or knowledgeable about how suicide bombers work nowadays. You pull a truck up and you ignite a tactical nuclear weapon and you kill 30,000 Marines at a time. We have no way of knowing. Dyson does not claim that this report kept tactical nuclear weapons out of Vietnam, but I think it was pretty important. Here's stuff he just did on the side. These are five things that each one of which probably would have made a pretty good career for any physicist. He introduced, the man says so himself, the field theory into condensed matter physics. This was a study of ferromagnets, starting with Charlie Cattell. Random matrices are used in nuclear physics to describe energy, the shuffling of energy levels, in condensed matter physics, in number theory, the Riemann zeta function has something, the random matrices are important there. Why is this table hard? He proved it mathematically in a really cumbersome proof. There were a couple of Princeton mathematicians who did a much better job only a few years later, but he and his co-author were the first ones there. Fundamental constants, a subject much talked about. Does the fine structure constant change? There are ways of measuring it. And Dyson wrote several papers on how to do that. In early 1970s, I think Steven Weinberg's book, The First 3 Minutes, Dyson felt that Weinberg had helped to legitimize a subject that had been sort of off limits up until then, and that was what happened at the very early part of the universe. Now, there are dozens of books on this subject, but back then it was kind of weird to write about this. Dyson wanted to write about the extreme late aspects, late period of the universe, and he wrote something like a 90-page article in Review of Modern Physics, which really was the first formal, big, full-fledged study of how, you know, galaxies die, planets melt, black holes gobble up stuff, and then they themselves evaporate. All bets are off with the coming of dark energy, but this was 1979 and it was an important paper then. Dyson has always been a popular writer. He'd written for Scientific American. For about 10 years, I contributed news items to Physics Today magazine, but Dyson probably over all these 60 years has written more articles than I did. He's written about 250 book reviews, little news items, and feature articles for Physics Today. I looked it up. You'd have to be a long-time Physics Today employee to have beaten out Dyson. The Sloan Foundation in the early 70s asked Dyson to write an autobiography that showed the nexus of science and culture. And this is the resulting book, his first book. Dyson is an excellent writer. If you can only read one book by Freeman Dyson, get this one. It's his first and best. And this led him off into full, what I call full Emerson mode, Ralph Waldo Emerson. My message is the unbounded prodigality of the life and the consequent unboundedness of human destiny. As a working hypothesis to explain the riddle of our existence, I propose that our universe is the most interesting of all possible universes, and our fate as human beings is to make it so. This nowadays goes by the name of anthropic principle, and you know, some of us in this room might squirm a little bit. You know, it's the most interesting of universes. Voltaire wrote a famous novel, and Dr. Pangloss was the hero of that. Pangloss thought that we lived in the greatest of all possible universes. Anything that happens, it happens because God wanted it to happen. And most of us don't want to think that way. But the more important point here is that human beings, you know, Dyson doesn't say that human beings were meant to happen or that they're conceivably the only intelligent species, but here we are, and we've got things like the KITP, and we've got these telescopes, and here's the whole rest of the solar system, and human beings have some interesting, maybe privileged role in that mix. His chief bully pulpit for stating his views these last 25 years is what I think is the finest literary magazine in the country, maybe the world, the New York Review of Books. There's Dyson writing a review of a book about Oppenheimer. And this will also, the rest of my talk is going to be about Dyson the heretic. And by heretic, I mean he goes against the grain. And, you know, we're all supposed to do that, aren't we? We usually say that you're supposed to take risks in your research. It's fine to say to young scientists, oh, be risky. No, you have to get tenure first. Then maybe you can be risky. Dyson has tenure. And I'm going to talk about, the rest of my talk will be about his troublesome views on, heretical views on certain topics. Let's start with Dyson the biologist. He spent a few semesters, sometimes in the summer, at UC San Diego. And he wrote a whole book. He came up with this idea that was so interesting to him that he wrote a book about it. It's the, nowadays, most biologists would say, what came first? And it's, you know, DNA or RNA, you know, it's RNA, and then RNA makes the proteins, and then somewhere, you know, about third place along comes DNA. DNA came a little farther down. Dyson said, no, even RNA was too early, that the early conditions for life on Earth were just too chaotic, and that RNA replication would have been so sloppy that you may as well not have, call it genetic at all. And so what was it? The early life forms he thought were just like a rag bag of chemicals. Nowadays, he believes, and this is not so controversial, that we live in a post-Darwin age, that the evolution of the human species, of the human brain, in a biological sense, isn't as important as culture in general. And I will come back to that point later. And just as a sideline, Dyson and Lawrence Krauss had a long-running battle about whether life could persist indefinitely in an expanding universe. And it went back and forth in the pages of Physics Today and Scientific American. And then along came the accelerating expansion of the universe, and now Dyson has sort of tossed in the towel. Nolo contendere. In 1860, the people in the South, in the United States, said slavery, you may not like it, but it's a necessity. We have to have it. We can't do without it. The abolitionists said, no, you're just going to have to find some other way of dealing with it. You can't have slavery, and it's a horrendous moral thing. Dyson and lots of other people say the same thing about nuclear weapons. I'm going to talk about, and he has argued for reduction in first in open-air testing and then in the total number of nuclear weapons. And I'm going to talk just briefly about the issue of no first use. If World War III had begun, many people think it would have happened right here. This is a war game board. This is the Fulda Gap in the middle of what was then called West Germany. And the Warsaw Pact had something like three times as many tanks as the NATO forces in Germany. And the American planners weren't idiots. They said, well, let them have all the tanks they want. If they come across that square right there, we're going to stop lobbing tactical nuclear weapons again. They even had a model called the Davy Crockett that you could shoot from a cannon, shooting nuclear weapons from a cannon. And Dyson said, no, that's not going to work. First of all, and this is the Bomber Command part of his brain thinking again, you're going to kill lots of Germans, lots of innocent people. Nuclear weapons across the board are genocidal weapons, and they're not going to work. If you want to, he's not against all nuclear weapons, but what he said was we have to subscribe to a no first use. We won't be the first to use nuclear weapons. And the United States government never accepted that proposition, and to this day, it's still not the policy of the United States. The Soviets did announce it, and you can say, yeah, we can trust the Soviets about this far. Maybe so, but they made that an official policy, and we did not. Dyson and many of his closest friends, like Sidney Drell, disagreed on this topic of no first use. They all felt that we do need that first use, at least in a very limited setting like this. Dyson would say, there is no limited sense. The Soviets have announced that once any kind of nuclear weapon is used, they may start using their full arsenal and all hell will break loose. Meta-science, what do I mean by that? The idea that there are forms of knowledge. About a month ago, I gave a talk here at KITP about science and literature, that there are different ways of viewing the world. Dyson's favorite poet, and he's also a fabulous painter, William Blake. That's a famous painting Blake did of, that's Isaac Newton, by the way, not wearing any clothes. He's plotting the universe there. That's the Principia, I guess. And what did Blake, and Blake wrote this long, epic poem about Newton. And in his view, Newton and the whole Enlightenment are terrible things. Why? Because they destroyed our communing with nature, that science had gone too far, was too reductionistic, too rationalistic, didn't leave enough room for many of the other beautiful things in life. The central complexity of human nature lies in our emotions, not in our intelligence. So Dyson went around arguing, and Dyson is basically an atheist, but he said, give religion a chance. So you can imagine how Dyson and somebody like Richard Dawkins are going at it all the time, and his buddy and Dyson's buddy Lawrence Krauss, the new atheists as they're called. So it's sympathetic writings like that that won Dyson the $1 million Templeton Prize, and that's him getting the award from Prince Philip. We could talk about the Templeton Foundation, but I don't want to do that right now. All right, so here's the thing. Here's the showcase event, the cover of the New York Times Magazine, What Are Dyson's Views on Climate? First, I will say that he does not deny that CO2 is increasing in the atmosphere. He does not deny that those big increases are mostly human-inspired. He does not deny that bad things are going to happen, you know, the acidification of the ocean or the melting of the ice caps. What he does say, though, is that the computer models, which we read about in the IPCC reports and elsewhere, are not good enough. He says, along with the bad things come some good things. Now, you'd like to ask, well, Mr. Dyson, you know, do you really think the Sahara is going to be the new California Central Valley? You can't predict that, you know, any better than you can predict the melting of the ice caps. He says England, from top to bottom, Great Britain, is entirely paved over. There are hardly any native species there anymore. And England's a pretty good place to live, isn't it? It's humans intervening in the ecosphere. And he says, if you really want to spend a lot of money, there are a lot of other things that need doing, that need addressing. And who could argue with this? And just for 5 seconds, I'll give you my own view. You didn't ask for my view, but I believe Dyson is wrong. I think the bad things are going to far outweigh the good things, and that we need to get rid of coal-burning plants. China and India getting rich is the most important thing that's going on in the world at present. That's another thing. He says a lot of things that look pretty good. Now, can anybody here argue with that? That's a pretty good thing to say. Unless it means we would provide this caveat that China and India both look as if they're going to burn, they're burning a lot of coal now, and they're going to burn even more. He thinks that humanists and naturalists might be at odds with each other. The humanist ethic begins with the belief that humans are an essential part of nature. Through human minds, the biosphere has acquired the capacity to steer its own evolution. Well, that's true. Here's how we would steer it with genetic engineering. The European Union doesn't want genetically engineered food, but we do have it in this country. You can say, well, haven't we been doing animal husbandry for thousands of years? Yes. Should we do genetic modifications on humans? And he says no. And yet, then he says this. Biotech games for children. He said genetic engineering is really going to come into its own when we have like laptop bioengineering kits for kids. The winner could be the kid whose seed grows the prickliest cactus, or the kid whose egg hatches the cutest dinosaur. These games will be messy and possibly dangerous. Shit, you know, is that enough to say that? He actually said that. All of this, yes, it's got to be messy. All of this, in his view, is part of this larger human epical arrow of history. Columbus's voyages were nothing compared to the Polynesian settlements of the Pacific. You know, this is the outer space of the 12th century. You know, it takes 80 years to get from there to there. You know, it takes 5,000 years to get from there to there and another 1,000 to get to there. He thinks, and you can't argue with him, but he at least takes the time to talk about where the human species is going and where is it going. It's probably going to get itself into space somehow, sometime. We've all seen beautiful pictures of Saturn from Earth. This is a picture of Earth from Saturn. That's Earth. Isn't that a lovely picture? So here, I mean, on the previous slide, he said he doesn't want to genetically engineer humans, but here he says, yeah, we're probably either we should do it or we're going to be doing it. First, adapt Earth to human needs. That's what I meant by terraforming the Earth. Isn't the Earth already terra? Well, not terra enough. We're going to go on modifying it. Then we adapt humans to space. Low pressure, temperature, gravity. In the short run, space travel, he says, is a joke. There is his daughter Esther in the Vomit Comet. She never did fly that cosmonaut. She paid like $5 million, but just as a backup cosmonaut, she didn't actually fly. This is a computer game. It used to be called Dyson, growing what are called Dyson trees. He thinks that comets are a far better place for human habitation than planets because the gravity is so much less. I mean, there's practically no gravity around a comet, but lots of water and maybe just enough minerals. And on a 10-mile wide comet, you could grow 100-foot trees. You don't need support for a 100-mile tree in outer space. And the leaves would have to be made from silicon. In the long run, here's the Kepler telescope, sort of a periodic table of planets that they found. If you go back to Orion and you start blasting, you can get yourself up to pretty high speeds and you can get across the galaxy, or to at least a Centauri in 150 years. Craig Venter says, yeah, then you could beam back genomes. That's very long-term thinking, so long-term that it's hard for any human being, much less a culture, much less the U.S. Congress, to vote big, big money. How can you begin something that big? Of course, when we look back, they found funding for the Apollo program somehow. So here's what may happen if we genetically engineer. Don't you watch the evening news, the violence in the Middle East or the violence at a Donald Trump rally, and you say to yourself, God, sometimes I feel as if there are two or three species. They're not just Republicans and Democrats. You know, we should live on different planets. Dyson said, yeah, that's going to happen eventually. And so inevitably, there are going to be people go to one planet and humans go to another. And like the goldfinches, the finches on the Galapagos Islands, you're going to have non-interbreeding species before long, human species. You know, it may take thousands of years. Tens or hundreds of thousands of years for this to happen, but he thinks it will happen. It's already happened.
The objects in Holmes' mass cause a great deal of gravimetric interference that might
prevent
us.
Oh shit! Why isn't the got the audio but not the video?
Could this be a Dyson sphere?
We worked for about 20 minutes to get the audio, and now we don't have the video. There's a planet-looking thing or a huge globe on the screen that they're all looking at and talking about. A star. That's the end of my talk. Thank you for your attention. He did not let me interview him for the book. I asked him if I could interview. And frankly, if somebody had come to me and said, could I spend hundreds of your hours of your valuable time in interviewing, I would have said no too. I asked him if he'd minded me interviewing his family members and his friends, and he said, sure, you got my blessing, go ahead. He did finally read the book, and he loved it, and he wrote a blurb for the paperback edition. So yeah, it's kind of late now, but better late than never. That was as a young man in Cambridge and even at Winchester, and he did conquer a couple of conjectures. He did prove them, and then there was another. I didn't stop to talk about this, and I forget the name of a particular number theory conjecture. And he told himself that if he proved this, he would stay in mathematics. If he couldn't prove it, he would jump over to physics. And he didn't prove it, so he jumped. But they're a bunch of publications. I didn't make a big deal out of his math career in the book because although he seemed to have a lot of promise then, you know, he basically left mathematics at the age of 23. He said many times the subjects that he chose were entirely appropriate to his mathematical ability. And one area his career as an astronomer, he said, didn't pan out because the problems he tackled just weren't well suited to his mathematical calculating abilities. So,
strange quote from Dyson about the burning coal in China and India. Did you really think that, or what was it? Because it didn't seem consistent.
Well, yeah, I read in this culture war, supposed culture war, between humanists and, you know, aren't we all in this room, humanists and naturalists? We all want to have it both ways. But what if you're, there's this famous, I was hunting for this cartoon for a long time and I couldn't find it, but it may have been in the New Yorker, about a South American. He's got a machete and he's chopping down his trees and he's setting them on fire. And then here's this fat ass American in his big Chrysler Imperial saying, yo, amigo, you know, stop burning that forest. We Americans can't really tell Indians and Chinese not to. Well, yes, we can tell them not to burn coal, but we have to sure lead by example. And we're still burning lots of coal.
But was that the sense of his remark?
If to feed people and to move the Chinese industrial development along, they need to burn massive amounts of coal, then burn the coal. And that's pretty much their view.
That was before.
It's changing now. I mean, anybody who's been to Beijing knows that it's They recognize, and it's in their official policy, official pronouncement, that they will wean themselves off of coal, as we were doing here. A month from now, I wrote an electricity book too, and I'm giving a talk. And probably the biggest thing that's happened in the last 7 years since that book came out is the reduction in coal. Then electricity is 90% of coal, or coal is only 50% of then 50%. Now it's about a third. To go from half to a third in just 7 years, that's a dramatic turnaround. And really, we were making up the difference with gas, and which is still a fossil fuel, polluting fuel, but much better. The CO2 burden is a lot less. So that's the sense. That was the humanist and screw naturalists. If that's he's on the side of humanists rather than naturalists. And again, you know, he's still doubtful that CO2 is doing as much bad as many people think. I think he's wrong, but.
I think you also said that he was arguing that the beneficial consequences were as important as the detrimental.
Let me add one thing that I forgot to say at that time, that, again, a great summer job that Dyson had for 3 or 4 years running in the early 70s, he spent with Jack Gibbons at Oak Ridge National Lab. And what were they doing? Computer modeling. So Dyson isn't just this doddering fool who knows nothing about computer modeling. He was one of the first computer modelers. And even then, you read, you know, his minority view, and Jason did a study too. And again, Dyson had the minority view to the effect that CO2 is not as bad as you think. Vegetables thrive on CO2. Studies have been made, you know, if you double the amount of CO2 over a cornfield, is the harvest going to be twice as much? And the answer is no, it's not. He will be 93 in December, and he's spending the semester down at UCS San Diego. And then we'll probably show up at Jason again when they start up. So he's still pretty active. I talk to him once or twice a year.
Wes, apparently Dyson and Feynman drew the diagram a little bit different way. Like Dyson, I think, drew them more of a uniform tension, or did I have it backwards? Anyway, I don't know if you were trying that.
I don't know enough about it. There's I think his name is David Kaiser at MIT, wrote a book just about how Feynman diagrams came into the world and how they moved around, almost like a virus. You know, it spread to the different countries, and you know, its first appearance in Africa, its first appearance in South America. It's very interesting.